Blog Talk Radio.
You know that the ice cream scoop can make a child smile, and that by slowing us down, the traffic light can keep us going. You know that the lawnmower makes life easier, that the blood bank makes life possible. But did you know all these ideas came from the minds of African Americans? Support the United Negro College Fund, because a mind is a terrible thing to waste. Visit uncf.org or call 1-800-332-UNCF. Brought to you by UNCF and the Ad Council.
Good evening and welcome to a special edition of the show. Thank you so much for tuning in. This is Joy Keys, your host. You can follow me on twitter.com/Joy Keys, and you can become a fan of the show. Just look up Saturday Mornings with Joy Keys. You can also send me an email. I'd love to hear from you. Saturdays with Joy Keys at hotmail.com. Any comments, suggestions, prizes you'd like to win but haven't yet? So please follow, become a fan, and send me an email. I'd love to hear from you. Well, this evening we are honored. I am just like in awe of my guest. If you don't know her, you should. If you don't know her work, you should. She has so many accolades. She was a poet laureate to the U.S. 1993 to 1995. She won a Pulitzer for her work Thomas and Beulah. She started writing her first book of poetry, The Yellow House on the Corner, from 1980. Her more recent book of poetry, Sonata Mulatica, was in 2009. She has 22 honorary doctorate degrees. 22. I don't have one yet, but I'm working on it. She just recently was the sole editor of Penguin's anthology of 20th century American poetry. Good evening, Rita Dove.
Good evening.
Go ahead.
I just wanted to say it's a pleasure to be here with you and to talk with you tonight.
Well, it's a pleasure to have you on the show, and I hope that the listeners, I see a lot of people in the chat room, if you have a question, you can call in. 646-929-0368. I hope they will enjoy learning about your work as much as I have learned and enjoyed learning about your work. I hope they enjoy it as well. I want to start off you were from Ohio. There are a lot of other famous poets from Ohio, Paul Laurence Dunbar, Langston Hughes, Alice Carey. Did you read any of these people as you were growing up, or how did you get into deciding to be a poet?
Well, I actually did read these people growing up, and every time, of course, you identify with things that touch upon your life. So when I, would see Ohio, my eyes would light up, and, you know, and any connection to that. But I grew up reading everything in my poetry, fiction, science fiction, even comic books, Mad Magazine. I just loved the fact that you could open a book and go anywhere in the world. And to me, it seemed very natural to progress from reading about these things to writing the stories that I didn't appear in. And it just felt like, well, okay, there's a man on Mars in this story, so I will write a story about a black girl, you know, on Mars. Mm-hmm. And so that's how I began writing. It seemed almost kind of organic.
Yes. Well, your first book, 1980, The Yellow House on the Corner, amazing. One of the more famous poems out of it was Geometry. And I remember reading it, and I could completely, you know, my interpretation of visualize, you know, the house, but also just internal, the mind expanding in a sense. What were your thoughts when you made that poem, Geometry?
That poem, well, first of all, I've always believed that poetry is about all of life and that it isn't just about the quote-unquote elevator topics, whatever they are. I come from a whole family of scientists, so my father is a retired chemist. So I never felt that kind of fear of math, or felt that it was somehow something else that I shouldn't touch. But this poem really came from the experience of when I was in 10th grade and the first time that math for me required imagination, not just adding up numbers, but you had to imagine things that weren't there. And so in that sense, it was very close to poetry. And this was the way, the actual way that I could imagine geometry by if I sat in a room and thought that the ceiling went on to the next room, but I couldn't see it. I had to imagine that it was there. So that was the same as a plane, you know, a surface that went on forever. And of course, it took many years later when I was writing poetry, when I thought back on that moment, where, that aha moment in math, which is so similar to the aha moment in art.
Yes, a form of enlightenment, I would say, almost.
Yeah, it is. I mean, it's that, it's the moment where suddenly the world becomes crystal clear, just for an instant, you know, you see through all of the problems and you see the path clearly. And that can happen in any discipline. What I really wanted to do in that poem was to point out that that could happen in math and geometry, that, you know, if the windows, if you could imagine them taking loose and hinging into butterflies, that they are going to some point true and unproven, which is what truth is about. I mean, it's true, and then it's also something you can't really prove.
Well, I think that's similar to poetry, because people have different interpretations. You know, I'm seeing one thing as I'm reading your poem, and another person will see something else based on their experiences. So there's a lot of difference depending on the reader. Another great poem I liked in that book was The Bird Frau, just the frantic nature and the imagery, and also that you are such a world traveler, and you bring that to your poems and the variety of your books. The places that you've been and the things that you've seen around the globe, you bring that into your poetry. Tell the audience a little bit about the development of that poem and why you wrote about that.
That poem is called The Bird Frau, and of course it has an English and a German word, you know, in the title, because I wanted to try to mix that sense of two different cultures and signal to the readers that they're not that different. You know, they can exist at the same time. And that poem is another poem that is actually based on a real experience. I was in Germany on a Fulbright, and I would walk home, there was a big hedged garden beyond which I could not see, but I could hear all of these different birds. And every day I would pass by and listen to these birds and began to imagine who could be behind that, you know, that hedge. So in that just that act of imagining what kind of history, what kind of emotional baggage, you know, was brought, you know, to bear behind that hedge, that so many birds live there, the whole history of Germany began to kind of bubble up again. So I imagine a woman, a bird frau, who began to feed all of the wild birds after her, you know, her son and her husband don't come home from the wars. But it's a pure, you know, interestingly enough, a pure act of imagination after the initial, you know, the initial scene, the thing that set it all off.
Yeah,
you know, and that can
yeah.
happen, you know, that can happen in poetry. I hope in the end it circles around and points to universal truth, which is that, you know, that every person can feel grief and misery and regardless of the circumstance that brought them to it, and that it is not, it's never good to just dump people into one pot and to say, oh, all Germans, you know, so she lost her husband in the war, so what, it was a bad war? She lost her husband, you know, and that's a grief that all of us can understand and deal with. So
that's a good point, because I think, like I was mentioning about you traveling and you being there as an African-American at the time, you know, to see, you know, I guess if you want to say white, which is a construct,
mm-hmm.
you know, we know that's a construct, but white people in a different light, you know, perhaps did that bring some awakening in you to have some empathy for people of different races, more so than maybe you had in the past?
Well, I think it did, you know, because I was raised to, you know, to treat all people as equal, of course, each of us comes out of our own social and historical constructs. And when I got to Germany the first time, what struck me was that all of the historical guilt and revenge and avenging, whatever you want to say, of American history was moot. I found that people did, yes, they looked at me as an African-American. They had their own idea of what that history was. But the sense of guilt was elsewhere. Let's put it that way. You know, they had their own kind of guilty
mm-hmm.
baggage.
Right,
but I began
right.
to realize that we all do that. We all carry within us all of the past seeds of our making, and we react out of that. And that one of the things that it taught me was that I could not jump to conclusions about what someone was like. I was treated as, yes, as an other, often, you know, in Germany.
Mm-hmm.
But it was a different kind of other than the other that I'm treated as here, if you know what I mean.
Here in the U.S.
Their assumptions
yes,
were
yes.
very different.
Yes, I agree. I was mentioning to you earlier that I was in Poland for 5 weeks, and just how people, oppression is oppression is oppression. And
mm-hmm.
the people of Poland, you know, have gone through such oppression at different times in history, and I could still see that on their faces and also hear it in their stories. And they were
yeah.
so similar to, you know, African-Americans, well, being afraid to go across the border. Well, here in America, being afraid to go to different states, you know.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
as a northerner, being afraid to go south, you know, not mm-hmm. having your papers in check, you know, all these things, such similarities. And I was so blessed to have that experience. So I think, expanded my empathy, you know, for the other, so to speak. But now, your other book that I really wanted to talk about, too, was Mother Love.
Mm-hmm.
And now this is getting into mythology. And
yes.
this is really the layers. Oh, my God, like I mentioned, your poems are like onions. And, you know, you take one layer and then there's another, and there's just all these layers and layers, the words, the colors. Music is also in your poetry, but we'll talk about that later. But let's talk about Mother Love. I'm a mother. You're a mother. How has being a mother affected your poems, and is that why you wrote Mother Love, because you have a child and you
yes, I don't think I could have, you know, I couldn't have written it, I think, had I not had a child or been a mother. Becoming a mother was profound. I mean, suddenly you are in charge of this life, and you have no training for it. You feel like, wow, no one has shown me how to do this. It's astonishing. So I think that certainly was one reason why I began to write the book. But after I began writing these poems, my daughter was just, she was 11, 12 when I was writing the poems that formed the book Mother Love. And this book is a series of sonnets. Most of them are sonnets or variations on sonnets. But they revolve around the myth of Demeter and Persephone, and which is a classic Greek myth. And you know, Demeter, of course, she goes off and she's kidnapped by the god of the underworld and taken down to the underworld. And I began writing the poems not actually knowing how they were going to come out, you know, why I was even circling this myth. But I do think that myths are and stories that stick with us are there because they touch upon something that's so elemental in us that we can, and you mentioned this earlier, we can feed in our own emotions, our own fears, our own stories into that myth, and it can help us, you know. So I trusted in this myth of mother and daughter to tell me some things also about how I was feeling about motherhood. And I still remember my daughter coming home from school one day and saying, "You're writing about us." And I was, at first I was totally shocked. I said, "No, I'm writing about Persephone and Demeter." And then I'm thinking, duh, of course I'm writing about us. I'm writing about a mother who is afraid that her child, when she reaches adolescence, is going to go off with that strange man, you know, who
mm-hmm.
a mother is always the god of the underworld, right?
I know that's right. Like, I see guys looking at my daughter now, and I'm like, you know. But at the same time, you know, I want love for her. I think love is healing and regenerative and all these things. And, you know, I want somebody to, you know, sweep off her feet and take care of her and all these things. But the process sometimes getting to that trench through all the frogs sometimes, you know.
Oh, yes.
So I think that, but in the book, Mother Love, also the death, you know, there are different types of death. There's the physical death, there's spiritual death, emotional death, mm-hmm. And that's all in the book, Mother Love. Also, in reading your poetry, you really need to be schooled in a lot of things. I just want to tell the audience, for some of your poems, there's a lot of, like you said, mythology, musical references, language, all the different languages that you bring up in your poetry. But in Mother Love, there's the poem The Search. And in terms of mythology, I was reading about Poseidon being the brother of the mother. Is that true?
Of Demeter. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and that he was it was like incestuous. He was in love with her and wanted to have sex with her. Is that true?
Yes, he was kind of. oh boy, yes.
So it's crazy, but so much is in your poetry. I just wanted to mention that for the audience, and just again the layers of the onion. Now let's get into the music in your poetry. You are used to play when you were younger the violin, is my understanding, and now you play viola da gamba.
Viola da gamba, yes. I actually start off with the cello. Because everybody, so I was being, you know, kind of contrary. Even I started playing cello at the age of 10 and continued playing it for all the way through college, and then finally switched to viola da gamba, which is an early instrument and not that well known. Music has always been in my life.
You also do classical voice training also, yes?
Yes, I do. I mean, I started taking classical voice lessons at a point when I, you know, was doing so much traveling, I couldn't drag a big cello around, and yet I needed my music. I needed to be in it, and so I began taking voice lessons as well. So I do that and take classical voice lessons, I consider this part of that extension of music has been my husband and I do ballroom dancing.
Mm-hmm,
and that's just getting physical with music, too.
Yeah. Well, that's very romantic. I see a lot of people in the chat room. You guys can call in 646-929-0368 if you have a question, or you can just type it right there in the chat room, and I will try to ask her. Also, I see people on the switchboard. If you have a question, just press the number 1. That'll let me know to pick up your call, and you could ask your question. Now, in terms of the poetry, in 2009, you wrote Sonata Muletika. And for those of you who are not familiar, that is actually about a relationship between Beethoven and an African-American, African and European composer, George August Polgreen Bridgewater. And in there you have a farce also. In the middle of all these poems, you put a farce in there. They were fighting about a girl, yes?
Yes, they were. And, in fact, that's part of the real truth of the whole story, is that, indeed, Bridge Tower and Beethoven were friends, and Beethoven composed a sonata for him and then tore up the dedication to that sonata after they had an argument over a girl. And so that is the real story, and Bridge Tower then dropped out of history, so to speak, and did not become known for the sonata that he inspired and premiered. But what the argument was with the girl and how they were fighting, no one knows. And so in the end, I decided in the middle of this book of poems to write a kind of a Mad Magazine-like farce in which the young George is talking up a girl that Beethoven also wishes would look at him.
Yes. Well, that's you're like a historian in a sense. You write a lot of historical poems, and you really are educating the masses with your poetry. you won the Pulitzer, where you talked about loosely, I guess, your maternal grandparents,
mm-hmm.
mythology, and another racism and other poems. Do you consider yourself, I think somebody, I read an interview that someone did with you, and they were saying, you consider yourself almost a historian slash poet?
Slash poet, I don't know. I mean, in an interesting, I don't consider myself a historian, but I I find it that flattering that someone would think that I was a historian, because they do such incredible work and such detailed work. But I do know that I am fascinated by those things that don't make it into the history books, which are, in fact, all of the common people, the individual stories. And each one of us, of course, you know, lives this way. I mean, we live our lives, and yet the big history is going on all around us, but we know what we ate for breakfast that morning or not.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
and all of that doesn't make it into the history books, and it gets lost. You know, it gets lost unless, you know, somebody writes a memoir, or unless someone, you know, hopefully writes a poem. And so I do find myself really drawn to those, to recording the unwritten history, the small h history, the, you know, the interior history.
Mm-hmm. Almost like an anthropologist, you know, or archaeologist, you dig up information and then you're, you know, you share it and mold it and form it. And it may not be exactly, like you said, we don't know what happened with the fight, but you enhance it and bring other lights and costumes, so to speak, you know, to the situation. Now,
yeah,
you just... Go ahead, sorry.
No. I just wanted to say that, you know, one of the things that was so important about that book was also to show that a mixed race, this mixed race violinist had a life. He to bring him to life, you know, so that we couldn't just put him in a convenient little category and say, okay, that's over and done with. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I wasn't aware of the person, and I'm sure there are many people who wouldn't even think that type of person, meaning a person who was
mm-hmm.
African and German
mm-hmm.
and, you know, I think his mom was Polish, at that time period was playing classical music. Like, it just
right.
wouldn't come to your mind. If somebody said, you know, this time period, that wouldn't be the first thing that's going to come to your mind. You know?
No, not at all.
so that is why it's so important, I think, that book. And then, you know, the other books are so important because they bring other things to light. And like you said, the everyday person and their goings on. Let's talk about the anthology. Wow.
Sure.
The Penguin Anthology of 20th Century American Poetry. Absolutely amazing. A mass amount of work you put into this. And you are the first person of color to be editor of a major general anthology. How does that feel?
Well, as far as I know, I am, and it feels kind of, well, you know, first of all, it feels overwhelming. Second of all I can say is what a shame. I mean, this shouldn't, you would hope we'd live in a society where we wouldn't have to have these kinds of firsts anymore. But we do. It just felt kind of amazing. I felt that the people at the Penguin were wonderful for investing that kind of trust in me, and then just letting me go. You're letting me go and amassing the poems that speak to us out of the 20th century, from all classes, from all races, from all, you know, aspects of the society. And it was an overwhelming task, but I also felt that, you see, I love poems so much that I kept going back to that and saying, you know, what, you know, you want to have a book that people can pick up and
okay,
carry.
Okay, can you hear me now? I'm sorry. I think I couldn't hear you for a little bit there.
Oh, okay. Oh, all right,
yeah.
All right. Well, let's
no,
see.
No, go ahead. Keep going.
No, no,
go
I was
ahead,
saying that with the Penguin, I really felt that that I wanted. I kept going back to the poems and saying I wanted to have a book where the reader could feel that it was a companion rather than a text that they had to master somehow, that they could dip in it at any point and get another viewpoint from someone about America in the 20th century.
Yeah, you have so many. How did you choose who to keep, who not to keep? I heard there was the issue with, you know, the cost and the fees of, you know, reprint. Talk to me about that a little bit.
Well, you know, the first, it is a very difficult thing to do because, first of all, I mean, just to pick people, and I started out by just going, it's like being in a candy store, I want some of that. You know, just the poets I absolutely knew that had to be in there, and then I would read them everything that they wrote, and in their letters, and then that would send me off in other little areas. So they gradually, you know, little conversations were going on between groups of poets in the book, so I could get a sense of the arc of the 20th century. Then comes the other part of that. That's the joyous part, right? You know, then comes the part of paying for these things and working with the budget. And most of everything was pretty good until we got to a certain publisher who shall not be named at the moment, but you can always find out who it is, because it's the publisher of Allen Ginsberg and the publisher of Allen Ginsberg and Sylvia Plath and Sterling Brown, who was absolutely intransigent, totally out of whack with every other publisher who had been, most of whom had been very, very kind. And then you get to the sad economic facts of publishing, so that in the end, I couldn't rob Peter to pay Paul to, you know, to finance those. And they broke off negotiations, even though we were working to try to include, to pay some of their fees, but for less poems. Anyway, they broke off the negotiations, and then I thought to myself, well, they held not only those major poets hostage, but they every poet that came from Harper, oops, I said it, but all the poets who came from, well, it doesn't matter, it's true, they simply withdrew all the rights. But then I thought to myself, well, you know, it is, luckily enough, I can say in my introduction, and I do, that go to the library, go online, you can find, luckily, you can find Allen Ginsberg, Sterling Brown, and Sylvia Plath online, and they are a vital part of the American history. But I used it as a kind of a teaching moment to say that, you know, an anthology is a political entity as well. You know, you get into this kind of stuff. But I was not going to let them not have the book come out because of that.
Yeah, well, I'm glad that you stuck to it. It took quite a while, and you had to leave teaching. How long exactly did it take to put the anthology from beginning to end?
I think it was about 4 years. 4 years, maybe a little bit more than 4 years from beginning to end. And it pretty much took over my life, yes.
You're almost like a cicada. You know, cicadas are like, what are they, in the ground for like 7 years or something?
7 years,
like,
yes.
And then they come out, you know? And then here you are. And
here you are,
millions
yeah.
Millions of them, you know?
It really was a labor of love, and I lived with it for all that time, and now, you know, it's out there for the rest of the world, too. Hopefully, that's well.
Well, I'm going to be giving away a copy of the anthology, so if you are listening, you want to follow me at Joy Keys on Twitter and become a fan on Facebook, just look up Saturday Mornings with Joy Keys, and you could win a copy of this anthology, but you got to follow, you got to become a fan. Again, I want to thank all the listeners. I see them in the chat room. You guys didn't ask questions, but you could. I see people on the phone, so you want to pick up the book if you don't win, The Penguin Anthology of 20th Century American Poetry. You don't have to be a poet fanatic to enjoy this book. There's so much variety, and there's, in terms of gender, in terms of race, in terms of age of the poet at the time. There's just a lot of variety, so I think you'll enjoy. So you want to pick a copy of that up. And also you want to pick up other works by Rita Dove and just support this wonderful artist so that she can continue and bring us more great work.
Oh, thank you. Thank you so much.
I want to thank you for coming on this evening, Ms. Dove. Thank you so much. I really appreciate you coming on.
Oh, I had a great time. And hello to all
your
listeners out there. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, have a wonderful evening.
You too. Bye-bye.
Okay, bye-bye. Thank you, everybody, for listening. I just got off the phone with former U.S. Poet Laureate Rita Dove. You definitely want to check out her work. From her first piece, The Yellow House on the Corner, still relevant today, to her more recent piece, Sonata Mulatica, which was in 2009, and now The Penguin Anthology of 20th Century American Poetry. I'm going to be giving away a free copy. Follow at Joy Keys and become a fan on Facebook. Thank you so much for supporting the show. Close to 74,000 downloads. Could not have done that without your support. Tune in Saturday, doing a show about sex trafficking with Rachel Lloyd Girls Like Me. That's Saturday the 19th. Thank you so much.